House Resources Committee to order at 1:03 p.m. Today is Monday, April 15. Members present are Representatives Tuck, Hannon, Tallarico, Rauscher, Rasmussen, Vice Chair Hopkins, Co-Chair Tarr, and myself, Representative Lincoln. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business, and before we get started, please silence your cell phones. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Doug Bridges. This afternoon, we will hear House Bill 122 by Representative Hannon related to the Funter Bay Marine Park unit. And then the committee will hear a presentation on Alaska's oil and gas tax production calculation from DOR. And first on the agenda is House Bill 122. Members should see the packet in front of them. And if Representative Hannon and your staff would please join us in the front and introduce the bill.
For the record, my name is Representative Hannon, and my staff with me today is Hunter Meacham. Hunter will be presenting the bill in its details, and she prepared the materials that are before you today. But as a retired teacher, I feel obligated to start with the fact that this is a project 77 years in the making. And there's been about two decades of active political work to preserve the cemetery in Funter Bay, which is due west from where we sit today, not very far. In World War II, six relocation camps were settled here in Southeast Alaska. People of the Aleutian Islands were relocated after the Japanese started invading the Aleutians. Funter Bay remained probably the worst camp, had one of the highest death ratios. Of the six locations that there were relocation camps in World War II, the Funter Bay Camp Site Cemetery is the only one that is on state property and unpreserved. And like I said, it has a large cemetery. The people that were settled on that, there were two Funter Bay relocation camps, one at a mine site, one at a cannery site. There was a site in Killisnoo, which is near Angoon, that is on private property. There was a camp in Ward Cove outside of Ketchikan that's on federal property and been preserved as part of a CCC camp. That camp existed before that, but there's one at the Wrangell Institute in Wrangell and Burnett Bay, where there is a fish hatchery today. The people who were relocated to the Funter Bay campsites were people who had already once been relocated from their traditional homelands in the Aleutians in the late 1700s by Russian fur trappers. People were moved to the Pribilof Islands and forced to hunt furs. And sometimes people will refer to the Funter Bay settlement camps not simply as relocation camps, but internment camps. For the men who were there were forced to leave their families in Funter Bay and return to the Pribilofs during the harvest time of the sealing camps that the U.S. government continued, and forced to return and leave their women and children behind in an environment that was not a traditional homeland. They were ill-prepared to survive and very successfully. The camp itself was very marginal in poor conditions, and a large cemetery ensued. About two decades ago, people started to work on making sure that that cemetery did not disappear. And the Unangan people, whose descendants, some live here in the region still today, and some return to the Pribilof Islands post-World War II, have sought protection for that land. I happen to have the privilege of just being the person in office who's bringing to a culmination a bill before you. But the dialogues around preserving this land in Funter Bay have been there for at least two decades. And there are a number of people who've been involved in that dialogue that are here with us today to provide expertise, and I do want to make sure I acknowledge very early on the leadership of the executive branch and the director of state parks and the regional director of the state parks who've continued to shepherd this to this stage to provide a land survey that would provide for the preservation of the cemetery plot at Funter Bay into an existing state park that is a marine park in title, and would give some upland lands that the cemetery is located, will add it on to an already existing state park and move it out of general mining and water status into a protected status. That's what the bill does. Hunter?
Again, for the record, my name is Hunter Meacham, and I'm staff to Representative Hannon. This bill, just kind of clarifying and restating, would transfer the parcel of land that the cemetery is on in Funter Bay from the Department of Natural Resources Division of Land, Mining, and Water to the Division of Parks and Recreation. To allow for its preservation, and so that we can always know its social and historical significance. Yeah. So this is a picture of the cemetery today, or recently. As you can see, it is pretty well maintained. I know a lot of the Friends of Admiralty, and they'll speak later, and family members have gone back to the cemetery to place new crosses. And then it's kind of a sobering image of one headstone, and you can see that this child was born about a month before relocation to the Funter Bay camp. And died in October, so shortly after, because the conditions were so terrible. So this is part of the survey done, and I know members have the land patent, and so I guess I can point out where the cemetery is. Yeah. Oh, I was showing.
We can share it
though. Yeah. Okay. So, sorry, I have this laser pointer. I don't want to like blind anyone. Mm-hmm. The cemetery is going to be right here.
That's really the extent of our presentation, because it's a pretty straightforward bill.
Thank you, Representative Hannon and Ms. Meacham. Representative Rauscher?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Totally great idea to me. Appreciate the presentation. What I'm wondering, is there any municipal land right now involved in this?
No.
And I was reading the survey almost, and it got kind of confusing. I don't quite understand how much area we're talking about. It doesn't seem like much, though. It's like 1,500 feet long and maybe 300 or 400 feet wide. Is that it?
The total acreage is about 500, but it's 537
acres. 537
acres.
Okay, thank you.
And we do have DNR online. This is Representative Hannon to address how they are moving and suggest that we move the whole a whole parcel of land that remains in state land, mining, and timber into the parkland so that it is contiguous and is not just a little outlying portion of just the burial plots. And they are Preston Cruz, who is the director of State Parks here in Southeast, is here in the room with us, and the director of State Parks, Ricky Geese, is online.
We do have some people invited, some invited testimony that is okay with the committee. We can go to and hold questions. And first up is Mr. Ricky Geese. Are you there, Ricky?
Yes, hi. This is Ricky Geese. I'm the Alaska Director for State Parks, and just wanted to come online to say this bill has our full support at all levels. It's been a privilege to coordinate and work with the diverse groups of very knowledgeable people and agencies and organizations who have been working hard to further protect this historical and culturally significant site and to help inform Alaskans about the importance of the cemetery and especially the hardships imposed on the Aleut people of St. Paul and St. George Islands in the Thunder Bay area during World War II. So Preston is in the room also if you have specific questions on details, but this has full support within DNR at all levels.
Thank you. And did you catch the question from Representative Rauscher?
Specific question through the chair. No, I did not.
Okay. So. Representative Rauscher, do you mind restating your question?
Yeah. I think I kind of have a better idea, but I'm still just, I guess it's quite a few lots, one through five, I believe. And then there's track 37 and 38. And it's a total of 537 acres. So now that I've read it a little more thoroughly, I'm starting to get a better picture of we're talking about multiple lots here. Is that correct?
Through the chair, I believe that is correct. If you have questions on specific lots, although I did visit the area recently, Preston is in much better position to answer specifics on specific lots.
That's okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Hopkins, and also for the record, Representative Sponholz joined us at about 1:03 p.m.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Geese, it looks like there's adding land, which covers the cemetery parcel, to a marine park. Two questions. Is this the first bit of land that's being added to the marine park, or is it more land and it already has some land included in it? And then is there any use management plan for this marine park that will be changed, or will it already adapt to having land included in that use management plan?
On the specifics of a management plan, Preston's in the room. He can give you a little bit better idea on the specifics of the management for the region, but as far as I know, there is some lands, and this is adding to additional lands that's in mining land and water currently right now. And this will just make sure that these lands are protected under state parks and have the authority for enforcement that comes with state park lands instead of just mining lands and water.
All right, thank you, Mr. Geese.
Do you have any further questions for Mr. Geese? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We may have questions for you later, but at this point, Mr. Crows, would you please join us? State your name for the record and affiliation.
Hi, my name is Preston Cruz, K-R-O-E-S. I'm the Alaska State Parks Southeast Regional Superintendent.
Do you have any testimony or just available for questions?
I was just available for questions to clear up any details.
Okay. Do you have any clarifications for the questions I already asked? Or?
Yes, I believe I could add a little bit. Mr. Co-Chair, as far as the management plan, the parcel that we are referring to that is part of the cemetery is currently in mining land and water designated to be managed as part of the state park, so nothing really will change as far as management. It'll be managed pretty much the same as it currently is and just be an addition to the current state marine park.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if we have been able to do a full assessment of all of our public lands for any important historical sites like this, or are you aware of any other spots like this that we should be thinking about, or sort of like have we done our work to make sure? Because you read these stories and they're so important, and you don't want to lose this history. And you know, you could see just in quick order how a site like this could kind of vanish if we don't take care of it.
Yes, Coach Yatar. To answer that question, I unfortunately would believe a lot of things like this are missed. That's why when we heard about it, we were more than happy, you know, to have it extend into the State Marine Park for just those reasons, to protect it, ensure it. It's going to be there for the cultural history. Mm-hmm. You know, it won't really be any additional burden on for budgetary. The State Marine Park is relatively generally undeveloped, mm-hmm. But we are hoping to get some interpretive panels out there for that area also.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I was just wondering, outside of that border that we've been shown, is the land status, ownership status there, is it all within state land, or are there other owners that butt up and are adjacent to that parcel?
Representative Tallarico, through the co-chairs, there is some surrounding private parcels in the immediate area. There's also National Forest property that is adjacent to the State Marine Park and the parcel that we would be expanding into.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure that this is the right question for the park through the chair, though. I'm just wondering, does anyone know how many people are buried in all of these plots?
Through the chair, there are 32 identified grave sites. The oral records suggest there could be some unmarked graves that are further outside the marked graves, but there are 32 marked graves.
And through the chair, a follow-up. And I'm just assuming that there's one, at least one, located on each one of these, denoted in the bill.
In each of the plots of the survey?
Yeah.
No. if I could, through the chair, Mr. Preston, he's asking if in survey plot 2, 1, 2, 11, and 12, are there grave sites in each of those? And I believe all the grave sites are located in parcel number 11. No. Tract A. So this is showing that all the state land that's being transferred.
Mm-hmm.
But the cemetery is in a very concentrated area. And this actually is showing you the full plot. Should be able to come up with the terminology. That's not really what it is. It's not a plot. What is the whole? A township. Okay. It's a township. Yeah. A full township. And the start, some of that township is not state land. Some of it's federal.
Each one of those is a section in the township. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And the need for all of that.
Representative Rauscher, through the co-chairs. If I'm understanding the question, the reason we're asking for the full 537 acres is to end up making it continuous, or, you know, for the current state park boundary. Otherwise, the cemetery parcel alone would be kind of a far outlier. So this way, it's one big continuous park that includes that cemetery.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Chair Lincoln. How big is this, like, what's the geographical size of the current cemetery in acreage?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chairs, I'm not sure if we have that exact number.
Is there?
It is a relatively small parcel. I'll just roughly 3/4 of an acre to an acre.
Quick follow-up. So I guess I'm just a little bit confused still as to why. I mean, I definitely support the cemetery, but I'm not sure why we're looking at 537 acres, if that's what it was, when we're talking about something that's an acre right now. Seems like...
Sorry,
a little
for
odd
the,
to me that we're taking up that much. I mean, a township is a pretty big...
Sorry for the low-tech drawings, but I had a feeling this might come up as a question. So, and these are somewhat zoomed in, and I'll feel free to pass them around. But so currently, like on this map, this purple area here is the current state park, state marine park. This tract right here is what we are adding. So that way it's connected. Otherwise, the cemetery is this asterisk over here. So there would be, you know, quite a bit of division mining land and water, which is also a DNR division in between. So since it's already a DNR state property, we just figured, you know, why not go ahead and make it part of the state park and eliminate jurisdiction confusion, basically. And then this map here is the same thing. It's just zoomed in slightly. So this is the state park. This is the tract we wish to add. And then this would be approximate of the cemetery.
Coach Tar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because I guess alternatively, it's sounding like if you didn't do it this way, there'd be, I guess you'd at least have to create some kind of access or things. That seems like it could get complicated. You'd have to put in like an access path or something to go to that other site. But now if you just make it one contiguous boundary, then it's all accessible. You don't have to worry about.
Coach Hurtart, definitely. It'll make the whole management plan and jurisdiction matters and everything just much more clear cut and easy to do.
Thank you.
Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. So this is a transfer of funds from one category, a transfer of lands from one category over to parks, from the mining and other natural resources category over into parks. This is not a swap.
It basically would be a title change.
Okay.
It's just going from DNR Division of Mining, Land, and Water to DNR Parks and Outdoor Recreation.
Right. Follow up?
Follow up.
Is there any resources on this land that will not, that, you know, are commercializable, that are not going to be able to be, you know, harvested or extracted because of this change?
Representative Sponholz, through the co-chairs, no. And that, again, is part of the reason for including this parcel under state parks. Mm-hmm. Is to better protect it, because under state parks we are different than Division of Forestry. We don't have commercial resource activities on our parcels, so it would better protect the cemetery and adjacent lands.
Sure. I guess it makes sense to me that it better protects the cemetery, which is the primary objective here, but I just wanted to get on the record that In moving this land over to the park, there's not any other opportunity cost that's being missed there. That in fact this is property that wouldn't be developed otherwise, and so there's not an opportunity cost in moving. And I think that is just something important to get on the record, so there's not any confusion about what the choices are here. That we're doing is protecting an important cultural resource for the Anangan people. And there's no other factor that could cloud our decision today.
Correct.
Thank you.
Maybe Mr. Geese, are you still on the line? He's dropped out. Okay. I thought maybe getting the perspective from the other department would be helpful. Any other questions? We'll take a brief Eddie's. On record, anything to add, Mr. Crows?
No, sir.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Our next invited testifier is Rick Iannolino. Sorry for mispronouncing your name. And is KJ Metcalf here also?
KJ is here.
Ben Monteith is the new president of the Friends of Admiralty. He'll
okay. Did you want to
testify? Yes, oh. He's here.
Okay. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and provide your testimony.
I'm Rick Iannolino, and I'm on the board of the Friends of Admiralty. I did the archival work for preparing for a visit by the survivors and officials from the Lucian Privilof Island Association, St. Paul and St. George. We went there 2 years ago. It was the 75th sort of memorial anniversary of that, and we had a ceremony with the Russian Orthodox Church blessing all those graves and putting a new cross, a large cedar cross, about 12 feet high. I wanted to real briefly, in the research, there were two things that stood out for me. And I did research at both the State Library and Archive and the Alaska Heritage Archive as well. This is from the Alaska Archive. All members of the, and this is presented by Roy Pravatovich, who was the Grand President in 1942 for the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood as well. He's Grand Camp. Approximately 500 Natives of Aleut, Kenai, and and Eskimo descent have been evacuated from the Aleutian Islands to the, by the U.S. Navy to Kalisnu and Funter Bay as a war safety measure. These people came with very little of their personal goods, and living conditions will be extremely difficult for them, especially this fall and winter. It is our patriotic duty to offer every aid and comfort to these fellow countrymen by gifts of friendship, advice, and assistance. At the present time, secondhand fishing gear of all kinds is needed by them to help them put up their winter food. U.S. Employment Service, which is actually the Department of Interior Fishing, Division of Fish and Game, actually, is trying to, Fish and Wildlife, to find jobs for them, and their main interest right now is building temporary homes in Kalisnu and Funter Bay. Actually, they were interned for 1 year, actually interned, and there was a court case that said they couldn't be interned by the Department, U.S., it was territorial days, of course, they couldn't be interned because they were U.S. citizens. And that's how they got out, but they actually were interned for a year, from 42 to 43. In 2017, actually May 20th, 2017, Friends of Admiralty had, again, a visit with their survivors and members of their families, and 100 people went over for the ceremony, again, blessing of the graves by the Russian Orthodox Bishop David. It was called the Healing Path. Healing trauma and wounds of the spirit is often a long path. In 1942, the steamer Belaroff sailed from the Privilof Islands towards southeast Alaska. Destination unknown. Their cargo was 380 St. Paul from St. Paul villages and 180 of St. George villagers and an additional 38 villages from Atco. All were being evacuated from a war zone. As the Belaroff entered the Gulf of Alaska, government agents were scrambling to find housing for the evacuees. The ship was radioed to drop off the St. George and St. Paul in Funter Bay in the Atka villages in Kalisnu next to Enspoon. Over the next several years, their story was one of people whose government forgot them, ignored them, and treated them as less than human. Today we revisit, and this is 2017 now, today we visit the site of this dark chapter of Alaska history with some of their survivors and family members to hear their stories. We sail into the same harbor as did the Zelleroff 75 years ago. We walk the same beach path as did the evacuees. We gather at the cemetery to remember, and I guess this is 30 plus. It should be known that there were a lot of infants where the graves were not marked, and so we don't know. We're thinking about 44 graves with infants. So many babies died, and they didn't have resources there. So it was this 30-plus evacuees, Mark Graves, actually, who would never return to their home villages. Then we come today to honor those evacuees and families and acknowledge their suffering and losses. We come today to remind all of us how easily fear can result in creating victims, especially of the less empowered. We come today to pledge never again, May 20th, 2017. Thank you. Any questions? I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Ian Lito?
Iannolino, yes. Thank
Iannolino.
You.
Iannolino. What's your affiliation again? I forgot to mark that down. What's your affiliation again?
Oh, I'm on the board of Friends of Admiralty, and I did some of the archival work for this particular event.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Can you briefly just describe who Friends of Admiralty are?
Oh, the director actually is the new director will be.
Okay, I'll save that question for him.
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions for testifier? Thank you for your testimony today. And I will, was it Daniel Metcalf?
Monteith.
Or Monteith, sorry, spellings.
KJ Metcalf is just left.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, House Resource Committee. I'd like to thank you all for...
Please introduce yourself and the affiliation. Yep.
My name is Daniel Monteith, and I am the president of Friends of Admiralty. My background is I have a PhD in anthropology and archaeology and have worked in the state for over 35 years. I'd like to thank you for putting this bill forward, Sarah Hannon, and for the Resource Committee. Today, listening to this, I'll be very brief. Friends of Admiralty is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the research, education, and outreach for Admiralty Island and the monument. We have a membership of over 350 members at present that make up the communities of Angoon and Juneau and many other places now as members spread out. I just wanted to say today, I don't want to go through the history, but talk about a few key points. In June of 1942, as others have pointed out, the people from St. Paul and St. George, 290 from St. Paul, 190 from St. George, were relocated to Funter Bay. Over the course of a few years, at least 32 documented deaths, and as Rick was pointing out, we think there may have been more infant mortality while they were at that location. That location is actually a Alaska historical site, and it's site Juneau 975. I'd like to thank you for putting this bill forward. I think it's very important in terms of the state of Alaska protecting the Unangan Historic Cemetery site. In Kilsnoo, part of the Anungan people were buried there. Some of that has gone over to private lands, and the people cannot even go and put flowers on those graves now because private residents say, we will, you know, accuse you of trespass. So this is a very important thing that you're doing today, transferring it from one division to state parks and assuring that protection. So I'd like to thank you. And just end with something that I've said in other research in protecting historic sites and cemeteries in the state of Alaska. Respect for one's ancestor is important to the respect of the Anungan culture and their descendants today. So thank you, and I hope you'll go ahead with this bill and pass it.
Just for the committee's information and those present, so we're not planning to move the bill from a committee today. It'll be an opportunity for amendments, and we'll go through that process. So we'll take it up again at a later date. Okay. If you don't mind staying with this for a bit while we have some questions, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. How was this bay picked? How was Funter Bay picked for that time period on holding all the Aleutian people there?
That was the U.S. Military Department of Defense. They were heading down to Southeast Alaska, and they were looking for possible sites. In Funter Bay, you had an old cannery site, and you also had structures left over from an old historic mining operation. So they utilized those places in Funter Bay. They also utilized historic sites in Killsnoo. They also went down to Ward Cove, where there were old Civilian Conservation Corps structures, and also in Wrangell. And some of the young teenagers went to Wrangell Institute. So they were kind of spread across the way. And prisoners of war were actually sent to Excursion Inlet, where we had a cannery site.
Well, Mr. Chair, was there, is there, I know we have the grave site there that's still, still in existence. Is there any of these other cannery sites or other structures or anything else that still remain?
Yeah, there is quite a few. And the National Park Service and a colleague, archaeologist and historian Charles Mobley, actually did a nice site inventory and that. And this might be something that folks could refer to. But it has complete maps, history of the federal government's relations with these tribal entities and that. But yeah, there's other historic structures in the area. Most of them do not have much integrity in terms of historic structures and archaeological sites. But this particular area, of course, because it's a cemetery and, you know, ancestors are buried there, is, of course, a very important part and parcel.
Thank you, Rich. Appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? So I've got a question. So I don't perceive any sort of opposition to the intent of the legislation. I think there's some question on over the amount of land that needs to be transferred. Can you speak to that at all in terms of, you know, 540 acres approximately to protect 1 acre?
Right. I would have to defer to your state parks people, but part of the philosophy there is to have a continuous land from the state park and not have any parcels of land that are incongruent in terms of management and divisions. So this would put that entire area and not cause any corridors that would be differences in terms of divisions, my understanding.
So, but Chair, from your perspective, and, I mean, I understand that coming from a lands background, having,
yeah, it's, sure, it's a, sorry.
But from your perspective, in terms of protecting, like honoring their ancestors and doing the intent of it, is it necessary to provide that amount of land, or is it purely like a convenience, like sort of a technicality that, in terms of implementing it, or is there value in your mind to having that much land, or could we accomplish the task if we were to amend it to a smaller amount hypothetically?
I think if you protected it around the cemetery and gave adequate buffers, I think that's what they were trying to do, is ensure that there were buffers around that the integrity of that area would not be compromised.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I may,
yes, sir.
Our nonprofit Friends of Admiralty is, as you have seen and heard, been very much involved with the historical interpretation of that area, and are continue to dedicate money, time, and effort to helping with interpretive signage of that area to make it a very respectable area. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the work that you do. Our next testifier, Mr. Martin Stepitin. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Martin Stepitin. I'm from St. Paul Island, Alaska, and I'm a descendant of the people of the Pribilofs who were brought to Funter Bay, and I live here now, and I got involved with Friends of Admiralty during a cruise back in 2014, and that's whenever I learned about, I knew about this history already. I just, I got really caught up in it after I went on this cruise. And I have a speech to talk about all that. First of all, I just want to thank the committee for taking up this bill, Representative Hannon, and the many people who have helped get it to this point. My name is Martin Stepton. I'm from St. Paul Island, Alaska. Thank you all for allowing me to testify on this bill that will finally protect the Funter Bay Unungan Cemetery. Both of my grandparents were taken to Funter Bay from St. Paul Island in early 1942, and by God's will, they all survived. My dad was born here in Juneau in 1942 at the St. Anne's Hospital. I don't know how my grandparents got over here to Juneau, but I'm thankful they did. Otherwise, my dad might not have survived in the cold and run-down camps in Funter Bay, where many perished. My maternal parents' grandparents actually got married while in Funter Bay. They survived. My mom was born in 1951. A short timeline and three good points of why we should pass this bill. In May 2014, my wife and I went on a Friends of Admiralty cruise to Killisnoo near Angoon, where we would bless the graves and place a plaque on the cemetery grounds in remembrance of 17 Atka Unungans who died before the federal government would bring them home. The Atka Cemetery is in bad shape and still is to this day. After this emotional cruise, I got to meet all the board members of Friends of Admiralty, and this is when I learned the Atka Cemetery is on private land, and the owners, although they let us on the land to bless it, was unwilling to engage with us about restoring the cemetery or any kind of protection. This was frustrating and heartbreaking. After joining Friends of Admiralty Board, we quickly began researching the Funter Bay Cemetery, trying to figure out who owns the land the cemetery sits on. This was not an easy task. We had to do a lot of research. We eventually figured out that the cemetery sits on Alaska state land and is managed by the Department of Natural Resources, or DNR. DNR didn't even know they managed the land that the cemetery sits on. They had to look it up. This is the first point I want to make. Unlike the Atka Cemetery or the other five locations the Unungan Aleuts were kept, we can actually try to protect this cemetery from future development, logging, or use that would desecrate this sacred place. Working with members of Friends of Admiralty, State Parks, DNR, who has been very cooperative and accommodating through this whole process, and we are so thankful for that. We weighed our options for protecting the cemetery. We learned that there was a past effort to protect the cemetery by Charles Mobley, whose book my friend just showed you. We learned that this past effort to protect the cemetery by Chuck Mobley, he tried to have the cemetery grounds put on the National Historic Registry, but the efforts failed because of the rules of not allowing cemeteries on the National Historic Registry and the stringent rules to prove historical significance. We didn't want to try the National Historic Registry again, and recently learned that the National Historic Registry doesn't actually provide very much protection in the first place. For example, the infamous 4th Avenue Theater in Anchorage is on the National Historic Registry, but is slated to be torn down, possibly. Our friends at DNR suggested an Interagency Land Management Agreement, or ILMA. This would be a great way to protect the land, except ILMAs can be changed, renegotiated, or completely canceled at any time in the future by people who don't value the cemetery as we do. So we knew that this would not be a wise way to protect the cemetery permanently. That's when Friends of Admiralty and I approached Representative Sam Keto last year about getting the cemetery legislatively protected, but it was already too late into the session and we couldn't get a bill started. This is my second point. The cemetery is on state land, but this is not the state's fault.
This is not the state's fault. But by protecting this land, by protecting this land, we would recognize the history. With all the most important things about the history is those who don't remember it are bound to repeat it. Even my grandma used to say, late into her late 90s, she would say things like, oh, I hope it never happens again. She used to say that. My third point is simple. The Funter Bay Marine Park will be expanded a little, but it won't cost any money to manage the land. The value of protecting the social and historical significance of this land will cement the history for good, and we will never have to repeat this history again. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Okay, thank you.
Testimony now. That was very nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our list of invited testifiers. We'll now turn to public testimony. So public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Please join us, state your name and affiliation.
Hello, my name is Nico Sanguinetti. I'm the curator at the Juno Douglas City Museum. And I became involved with this project basically when I first started. I'm fairly new to Juneau, and as someone who didn't grow up in Alaska, this isn't a history I knew about. It's a complete event that isn't often covered in historical texts or in historical classrooms pretty much around the country. And as I moved here and took on this post, I immediately was greeted with this very large and ambitious project run mainly by the gentleman behind me. And as part of this project, the City Museum is planning to do their summer exhibition, which is the largest exhibition we have each year, next year for May of 2020 on the Funter Bay internment camps. In preparing for this exhibition, as many people probably know, museums plan very far out in advance, which means that there's been a lot of research being done, and I've benefited greatly from the research that Rick Iannolino has already done in regards to digging through archives for the scant amount of records that remain. This entire event, it has been characterized by a lot of confusion, and trying to iron out what really happened has been very, very difficult because so many agencies were involved and so many people were taken places that were never planned to house humans at any point. As a result, we have this opportunity to protect this cemetery, which is the resting place for people who were moved without their consent and without knowing where they were going to even end up when they boarded that ship. I understand that there's questions about the space between the cemetery and the state park, and as other people have testified today, the main portion is that we want to make sure that for future generations, people will be able to visit this site unimpeded, that it is going to be protected in perpetuity, and that the area around it will also be protected. As many people know, with historic sites, you can protect the site itself, but if right next door, they're digging things up, they're shaking the ground, they are causing a lot of damage that you may argue is not to the site itself, but there are a lot of things that can happen that remain unseen that cause a lot of trouble later on. So we want to make sure that there is that connection between the parkland and the cemetery land. So not only protecting the cemetery, but the people's right to visit it, to visit their ancestors, and to continue to do so for many years to come. I want to thank everyone for hearing this bill and for Representative Hannon for putting it forward. And thank you very much to the wonderful team that's been working behind the scenes for this for many, many years, long before I was able to join it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you have any questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify? Please state your name and any affiliation for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Chuck Smythe. I'm the director of the Department of Culture and History at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. And I'm just going to speak in favor of this bill. I got to know the significance of this site from people starting first time I went out to St. Paul and St. George in 1981, and heard firsthand from people whose parents were there and who were there themselves, and how when they were brought here, they brought to this cannery, you know, the experience they went through. How, you know, there were, I don't know if you guys have been hearing any of the testimony or read any of the reports, accounts of that experience, but how, you know, there were holes in the walls and in the ceilings, and they had blankets separating the families' living quarters, and very cold and not much food, and without the help of A&B, they might have starved during that time period. When the ships came to pick them up, you know, they talked about how they were given 2 or 3 hours to gather up their belongings and go there. So it's a very important, significant site historically for the people on the Pribilofs. And so I just wanted to mention that, going back to that history of the site and the families who lived there and went through this experience. The other point I think under discussion today is whether there should be just 1 acre or a larger land area set aside for this. And I can only speak from my experience with, I used to work for the National Park Service for 12 years and know that there's a big difference between protecting a 1 acre site and a larger site in terms of funding, in terms of recognition of the site and ways to go about protecting it. And having a larger land area provides a much greater recognition, a more significant type of recognition for an area to protect that would enhance the ability of those interested to protect it to do so. That's kind of in a nutshell.
Thank you for your testimony. And are there any questions from the committee? I just maybe I wasn't clear enough earlier. I definitely didn't mean to imply that anyone on this committee is interested in only setting aside 1 acre. I think we're just trying to get a sense for the area, and there's, you know, perhaps some place in the middle, or maybe the whole 540 acres is fine too. I just wanted to hear from, you know, those of you who are very interested in, you know, the mission of the legislation, what sort of area around the site would be sufficient to protect it from adjacent development and whatnot. So that was the purpose of that question earlier. Do you have any comment on that? Is the full 540 acres sort of the minimum in your mind, or?
I really don't have an opinion on that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I can't.
Okay, no, that's fine.
And then for an opinion.
Well, the committee will have some more time to work on this too and have their questions answered. We'll take it up again, I believe, is it Wednesday? Okay. Yeah. I think amendments are due. Brief eddies. Back on record. So we will take this bill up again soon.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just, to everyone that commented, because I was getting pretty emotional, it doesn't always happen in Resources Committee, but I just wanted to say thank Martin for sharing your personal story. That was clearly, like, difficult to share. And I know we have a lot of big things before us, but whenever we do work that is about righting the wrongs of the past, I think it's among the most important things we can ever do. So thank you for sharing.
Is anyone online that would like to testify? And is last call for anyone in the room? Please state your name and affiliation, if any.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't planning to testify, but I thought I might be able to respond to some of the questions that were raised. My name is Reed Stoops, and I'm here as an individual. I'm here because I bought the old cannery site 30 years ago that's in the middle of the property right next to the cemetery. So I've used it half a dozen times a year since then, so I'm pretty familiar with the history and the current status. In one of my old jobs, I was at Department of Natural Resources dealing with land management, so I'm familiar with that perspective as well. I support the legislation. I think it's a good idea. I think that as to the size of the parcel, there's really no other commercial value of that property. It's de facto recreation. There's probably 20 cabin sites in Thunder Bay that are used for recreational purposes, mostly from people who live in Juneau or elsewhere in Southeast. There's lots of commercial fishermen, recreational boaters, kayakers, campers that use Thunder Bay in the areas that aren't privately owned. It's 500 acres sounds like a lot, but the way it's scattered along the shoreline, it's really a lot of shoreline and not very deep. There's no commercial timber there. There's no mining potential there. It's already heavily used for recreation. It's surrounded by National Monument. So I don't think you're foregoing any economic opportunities by only protecting the area immediately around the cemetery. As to Representative Tuck's question, some of the old buildings are still there on our property. We saved what we could save. A lot of them were too far gone to save. The old bunkhouse where the LEU people lived has fallen down, but when we first purchased the property, it was still barely standing, and I just can't imagine the living conditions of the people who lived there. It was not much bigger than this room. There was no insulation. Apparently had 30 or 40 people living in it. It was really tough conditions, not something that any of us would want to endure. So anyway, that's unless you have any questions, I would urge you to support the legislation.
Representative Rocher.
Thank you, through the chair. I was just wondering, Mr. Stubbs, yours is considered private land?
Yeah, there's there's the old cannery site, there's the old mining site, and a few other trade manufacturer sites patented back in the early 1900s, and those have all been sold and developed into recreational cabin sites.
So it is kind of a recreational area right now?
Yeah, it's used heavily by people in Juneau, Gustavus, and Southeast, generally a lot of boaters that come through. Anchor up in Thunder Bay. The commercial fishermen use it as a place to get out of the weather or just spend the night while they're fishing. A lot of people go there for the weekend to go salmon fishing and end up camping on the beach or sleeping on their boats.
Do you have any idea how many private properties there are in the area?
I'm guessing there's probably 20 private tracts, all of which have cabins on them.
Closer to the part that we're making contiguous from?
Right.
Or does it go the other way?
No, the bay is probably a mile deep, and I'd say the majority of the private properties are on the south side of the bay, but there's some in the back. There's one contiguous to the cemetery, and then the property that I have is now 9 lots, and that's almost next to the cemetery. So there's plenty of private land already in the bay that's already been developed, and what's left is probably best left to public use, because if you sold the rest of it, public wouldn't be able to use any of the bay.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Stutes?
Thank you.
Appreciate you deciding to share your testimony today. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify? Anyone online? Seeing and hearing none, we will close public testimony on House Bill 122. And again, we will there'll be an opportunity for amendments and to learn more about this bill, but we'll plan to pick it up again soon, and staff will be in touch with committee members about that. So we'll take a brief at ease while we get set up for our next presentation from DOR. Back on record. Our next item today is a presentation on Alaska's oil and gas tax structure. Would Commissioner Bruce Tangeman and Mr. Dan Stickle please come forward? Put yourselves on the record.
We almost worked. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Revenue.
And for the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Revenue Economist with the Department of Revenue.
So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we are going to tell you everything you need to know about Alaska's oil tax system in 52 minutes. And I know the co-chair is laughing because she knows this stuff quite well. It is a rather complex discussion. We presented this over in the other body, and this is Dan will do it. It's a technical walkthrough of exactly how the tax structure works from a fairly high level. No policy, no politics brought to this discussion. It's just going to talk about the facts on how the math calculation works. So I'll turn it over to Dan so he can get rolling on it.
Sure. Again, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Dan Stickle. Slide two is just a list of acronyms that we use throughout the presentation. There's a lot of jargon and terminology used in oil tax and production tax in particular, so we just put some of the acronyms from the presentation here for the benefit of the committee and the folks watching at home. We'll try not to use too much jargon as we go through. Moving on to slide three, overview of the presentation today. As the commissioner mentioned, the purpose is to explain the nuts and bolts of the production tax and fiscal system that applies in the state of Alaska, what we have and how it works, as opposed to the policy discussions, more of making sure that that everyone in the public has a firm understanding of what the existing structure is and how that works. So we'll start by looking at all of the sources of oil and gas revenue to the state, and then we will move into a detailed walkthrough of the production tax and each step of the calculation. Our focus in the presentation will be on North Slope oil, as that is the main source of revenue to the state, except for federal and investment revenue. For the presentation, we'll walk through the fiscal year 2020 cash flow distribution, and then at the end we'll do a five-year comparison. And as an addendum to the presentation, if there's time, we have a few slides on distribution of cash flows, how the North Slope oil profits share between state government, federal government, and producers.
Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I was just wondering, we're 2017 through 2021, how did we decide we're going to use those years?
Sure. Representative Rauscher, through the chair. So what we wanted to do is present 2 years of history, which are fiscal year 17 and fiscal year 18. Fiscal year 19 is the year that we're currently in, and then 2 years of forecast, which would be fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 21. That's how we came up with those 5 years to look at.
Good, thank you.
Moving on to slide four, Mr. Chairman, a disclaimer as we go through the presentation. In this presentation, we've attempted to take a very complex tax system and distill it down to understandable and simplistic pieces. What we have here is based on aggregated data and our forecasted estimates for different items and portions of the tax regime. I am an economist, and so anything I say should not be interpreted as an official tax interpretation. It's my attempt to walk you through the revenue forecast to illustrate the tax calculation. So moving on to slide five, Mr. Chairman, Alaska receives state revenue from oil and gas from four primary sources. The first is state royalty. This is received for any production from state land. We also receive a shared royalty for production on federal land. Royalty is typically The typical royalty is a 12.5% state royalty, or 1/8, but there are royalty rates that differ from that. We receive revenue from corporate income tax. This is a tax that's based on worldwide net income for companies doing business in Alaska. That worldwide net income is then apportioned to Alaska, and the Alaska tax rate with a top marginal rate of 9.4% is then paid on that Alaska taxable income. We receive a property tax that applies to all oil and gas production-related property anywhere in the state and in the state's three-mile limit. And then finally, the revenue source that we're focusing on in today's presentation, the production tax, that's our severance tax on oil and gas, and it applies to all production anywhere in the state and within the state's three-mile jurisdictional offshore limit, regardless of whether that production is on state-owned land, federal-owned land, or private land.
I've got a question on the slide. So with regards to the corporate income tax, so there's C-Corps and then other types of corporations like LLCs, right? The LLCs are not subject to the corporate income tax?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. An LLC or a partnership, those are pass-through entities. And so if that income passes through to a C-Corp, it would be taxable. If it passes through to an individual return, we don't have an individual income tax at this time.
And historically, the production in the state's been with pretty large companies, right, like the BPs and the like. And has there been a trend or a change in terms of like the overall makeup in terms of there's smaller companies in the mix now? Is there, if you looked at a sort of a percentage of corporations that are active in oil and gas, are there like a ratio of C-Corps to non-C-Corps? Is it changed over time? Is it affecting the amount that the state's collecting in taxes because corporations are organized in a different way today than they were 30 years ago?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a ratio at the handy. You are correct that historically, as well as currently, the vast majority of production is by C corporations. There are some non-C corporation entities that are involved in production currently.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Through the chair. And so let me just conclude that question that Chair Lincoln started on, which is, so if we did have an individual income tax in the state, some of those small independents that might be operating as LLCs, we would be able to get a taxation off of, but because they're not C-Corps, we don't.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And actually, I was thinking, too, of also the relative split between state and federal, but I know we're going to get to that when towards the end, so I'll hold off on that comment.
Sure. Moving on to slide six, Mr. Chairman. This slide puts dollar amounts to the sources of state revenue from fiscal year 17 through the forecast for fiscal year 2021. A few notes on this slide. The property tax shown here is the state share of the property tax only. In addition, there's a municipal share that's actually quite a bit larger than the state share. Corporate income tax, there were prior year refunds that impacted the collections in fiscal year 17 and 18. So now when we're looking at the fiscal year 19 and 20 numbers of around $200 million a year, we believe that's a better estimate of what to expect from corporate income tax over the long run. We have the production tax, which is expected to generate a little over $700 million this year. That's the focus of the presentation here. Royalties, which include bonuses, rents, and interest. This royalty number of a little over $1 billion a year includes general fund royalty. It also includes the permanent fund and school fund shares of royalty. In addition, when you look in our revenue forecast or the revenue sources book, there's two other categories of petroleum revenue. One is settlements to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. This is based on any assessments or resolution of disputes regarding past year's production tax, royalty, and minerals-related corporate income tax. And then finally, the state receives a share of revenue from the National Petroleum Reserve, which is federal revenue. Right now, the numbers have been fairly small. We're looking at $8 million this year and $11 million next year. This is expected to become a much larger number, exceeding $100 million per year by fiscal year 2028 as new developments in the NPRA come online.
Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this slide is a good place to just sort of talk about the interrelationship of those of these taxes, though, particularly if you look at like FY 2017. And I just want to mention this now because, for example, if we have an a year where we have a dip in price, right? That really hits us on the production tax, and that's more obvious to folks, but it also hits us on the corporate income tax. So, you know, in a year like that, that's why you get negative on that, because if the price is so low, right, that there's no profits, then that's going to hit on the corporate income tax side too. And then it's also going to hit on the royalty side because of the low price. So just so many of our things are price dependent that when we have a low price environment, we really lose out in every area. And I think, I don't know if you want to comment on that, but it's just sort of, I think it was something that I didn't kind of like appreciate until we were looking at all of the numbers together, about how, you know, how that really impacts everything. And then so much so that on the corporate income tax, right, then, you know, we actually have negative in some years.
Sure. And Representative Tarr, through the chair, with the corporate income tax in particular, there's a provision wherein a company has a net operating loss in a given year. They're actually allowed to carry that loss back for up to 5 years and claim refunds on prior year taxes paid. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of the story of what brought the corporate income tax to a net negative number in fiscal 17 and then a lower number than fiscal 18 than otherwise would have been the case.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Rusher, do you have something? Or?
Yeah, I did. Thank you. Through the chair, just to follow up on Representative Tarr's question, in a low price environment, we lose out, I believe was a statement. So does everybody lose out equally, or do they lose out disproportionately?
Representative Rouster, through the chair, and we do have a couple slides that will address that question quite well in the addendum at the end of the presentation. Since we have elements of the fiscal system that are based on gross revenue, the companies actually lose out disproportionately more in a low price environment. And we will have some slides that get at that at the end.
And an unrelated follow-up question. I was just wondering, my geography is really bad. NPR, is it 100%? NPRA, is that mostly 100% of the, in a municipality, none of it in a municipality, some of it in a municipality? Or how does that work out over there?
Sure. Representative Rouser, through the chair, the NPRA is that it's a portion of land to the west,
right,
of Alpine. It encompasses the Willow and Greater Moose's Tooth development. I believe there are communities within the Petroleum Reserve. That would.
I'm getting a nod. Thank you.
Excellent.
Appreciate it.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So FY, just for purposes of this chart, just make sure I'm correct, I'm reading this correctly, but FY20 and FY21, those are forecasts. Everything else are actuals, with the exception of FY19 is close to actuals we can get at this point, right?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, that's correct. So this is based on our spring forecast that was issued in March. So the fiscal year 19 number actually represents a little over half a year of actuals and then 4 to 5 months of forecast.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, this is sort of also in follow-up to Co-Chair Tarr's question. When she was pointing out that that the low-price environment in 2017 was had a big impact on our budget. As we're moving forward, if I remember correctly from the revenue forecast, and I wasn't able to pull it up right now, we're not anticipating major ups or downs in revenue in the price for the near future, and our production forecast is expected to be fairly stable as well. So what accounts for lower revenue that's projected here in FY20 and FY21?
Representative Sponholz, through the chair, fiscal year 19, you'll notice the first line here is ANS oil price.
Mm-hmm.
You do have a slightly lower price in fiscal year 20 and 21, and so that's part of the story of what's going on here. There was also some one-time payments on production tax that we received in fiscal year 18 as well as fiscal year 19.
So basically the follow-up, the $3.80 drop is what accounts for the difference in royalties and production tax.
That's correct.
All right, thanks.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Turning to the CBR fund settlement, big drop from 2017 to 2018. Could you help me understand that?
Sure, Representative Hannon, through the chair. Fiscal year 17 was an unusually large amount of settlements. There were some major settlements that took place in that particular year, and this range of in the $100 to $150 million is probably more indicative of what we can expect in a typical year.
Follow up, just to make sure I so when you say settlements, so litigated disputes that had been going on with the state that were all settled that year. So it wasn't all, it was all received that year, but it wasn't all necessarily earned that year.
Representative Hand, that's correct. So this is going to be, it could be litigation, it could be audit assessments, but typically this is going to be revenue received in fiscal year 17. And yeah, those would be for, it could be a few years before some of these settlements go back, you know, many years, up to a decade prior.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you. Chair Lincoln, I have a quick question. So I was in another presentation or something in the past where they said about a dollar change is equivalent to about $100 million in revenue. Is that pretty accurate, would you say?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, we've been using an estimate of about $70 million in terms of general fund. Because of the way that the production tax works with the gross, there's a gross tax and a net tax. Once you go above current prices, it's going to be in the $70 to $100 million per dollar of price change. When you go below current prices, it's going to be a little less than $70 million.
Quick follow-up. Is there, do you have a comparison about what a dollar change in the price per barrel would have looked like under the ACES plan as far as revenues?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, we could.
Yeah, I'd like to, for the record, Bruce Tangeman, it's very difficult to go backwards in time, and because we do get these questions, what would a tax structure have looked like under this scenario or that scenario? We have a net tax system, so it is impossible to go back and give an accurate estimate had a different tax structure been in place, because the biggest driver under a net tax system are capital and operating expenditures. So again, we're sticking with just the facts of what we know. We do have a history under ACES, we have a history under SB 21, but trying to assume the private sector's intent under a different tax structure, you know, if SB 21 had been in place instead of ACES, we're, as the Department of Revenue, are not going to go out on that limb and assume CapEx or OpEx would have been affected one way or the other, plus or minus, because now we're getting into policy and political decisions. So looking backwards, trying to apply different tax structures, especially when you're looking at, you know, we had rather high prices under ACES and rather, you know, 40, 50, 60 under SB 2021. So it makes it very difficult to attempt to do that. Consultants do, and consultants can, but the Department of Revenue would rather stay out of that game, especially they're such vastly different tax structures.
Quick follow-up. Does the Department of Revenue have a record of the income that we saw then and what we were looking at as far as the daily production? Is that something that is available?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, yes, we do. We've got CapEx, OpEx, all those details, certainly, and we can point you in the right direction because they are laid out rather well in the revenue sources book.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, again, Dan Stickle for the record. If I may move on to slide 7. So this moves into the production tax, and this is our income statement table looking at fiscal year 2020. The table has a lot going on, and so we're going to spend several slides unpacking it piece by piece. This table, some of you may be familiar with it. It appears on the in the back of the revenue sources book each fall, and we've updated this version for the spring forecast. We start with an average price forecast of $66 per barrel for fiscal year 2020 and a daily production estimate of 529,500 barrels per day. Those numbers calculate out to the annual barrels and dollar value of that production. So about 194 million barrels of production on the North Slope for a total value of about $12.8 billion sale price. And so our focus on the next several slides will be starting with that $12.8 billion and looking at where that goes and how it is split and taxed. So a few notes, this is an aggregation of all the different companies doing business on the slope intended to illustrate the production tax calculations. And again, it's just for the North Slope oil, which is the largest source of production and revenue. So walking through the income statement, we'll start at the top on slide 8. Step 1 is calculating the taxable barrels. Any royalty barrels are subtracted from the production tax calculation regardless of the ownership of those royalty barrels. The typical rate is 1/8 or 12.5%, but the rates do vary. So the average royalty rate in the current year is actually a little less than 12% on average. In addition to state royalty, we also subtract federal and private land royalty here to get to the total taxable barrels. The federal land, for example, would include the offshore portion of North Star. Once online, the Liberty Field would also fall into this category of not being taxable. So we arrive at the average, at the taxable barrels estimate of 172 million taxable barrels in fiscal year 2020 with a total taxable value of about $11.36 billion. Slide 9 looks at calculation of the gross value at point of production. This is also termed.
Representative Hopkins has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, you said that Liberty would not be taxable, and what was the other field?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, Liberty is outside the state's jurisdictional limit in federal waters. There's a portion of the North Star field that also falls into that category. It's actually, it's part within the state's limit and it's part outside the state's limit.
So we receive $0 from Liberty as a state? No.
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, specific to what we're looking at here, as it's currently understood, the barrels from Liberty production would not be considered taxable barrels for production tax purposes.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, follow up. In just these two lines, or by the time we get to the bottom, Liberty would not have calculated into state revenue?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, Liberty, as we currently understand it, would not be taxable for production tax purposes. There would still be some benefits for any onshore infrastructure and property tax, the obvious benefits of having production down the pipeline, things like that. But for production tax purposes, Liberty would not be taxable barrels.
Thank you. And then one quick follow-up. That's a 2-mile, 3-mile? How far out is that island?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, it's beyond the 3-mile limit.
3 miles. Okay, thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your slide 5, you said that severance taxes happen regardless of who owns the land, with the exception of being beyond 3 miles of our shore. So anything within 3 miles of our shore, whether it's federal, state, or private, and so anything beyond that is not subject to state tax. Is that correct?
Representative Tuck, to the chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Chair Lincoln. From my understanding, like the Liberty Project, for example, would still be responsible for paying a state income tax. Is that accurate or incorrect?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, to the extent that the operators are C corporations and to the extent that that project impacts their production, well, it wouldn't be production, but property and sales in the state of Alaska, there could be potential corporate income tax impacts.
Okay, thank you.
Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But then in that example, that would be one of the circumstances where we'd want to think about the carry forward losses, because of course that's going to be a pretty costly development. And so at least for 5 years, any of their net operating losses could be carried forward and applied against the corporate income tax. And I think if you were modeling that, you probably expect those early years to show up pretty low or negative because of the net operating loss carry forward.
Yeah, Representative Tarr through the chair. So looking at the question of how an offshore development not in state waters would impact state corporate income tax, it's actually a kind of a tricky math problem, because it would impact their worldwide income. It could potentially impact the company's apportionment factors. It's complicated. And I did also want to put on the record, since we're talking about Liberty and Royalty in particular, that Alaska would receive about 27% of the royalty for production from Liberty.
Me?
Sure, Representative Tuck.
I just want to clarify, through the chair, I want to clarify this last statement. So you're saying 27% of the federal royalty, or you said 25% of royalty of what? Of the 100% of the of the value, or what do you mean by that?
Representative Tuck through the chair. So of the royalty portion that the federal government receives, there's a sharing provision in place that 27% of that would get shared back to the state of Alaska. Thanks for the opportunity to clarify.
And if I may follow up, and is that true for anything close to Alaska that's beyond 3 miles on federal lands? Is this flat 27% royalty, or is this specific to projects in areas within Alaska?
Representative Tuck through the chair, I believe that provision applies to production beyond 3 miles and out to there's another limit.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you can track that answer down and provide it to.
Yeah, absolutely, Mr. Chair. We have a handout that we've provided in previous years that lists out all the different land ownerships and how those all apply for tax and royalty purposes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. On the federal royalty share of the Liberty project, what's that percentage? Is it near our 12.5% at the state level, or is it very different?
Representative Sponholz to the chair, I don't have that number off the top of my head. We'll be happy to provide that.
I'd be very curious. I think 27% of, you know, of a different percent is just a much smaller percent than we might be thinking. So it's important to understand what we're talking about, what the 27% is of.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. And does that federal, the royalty share that we get of the federal royalty, is it irrelevant whether it's 3 miles offshore or the NPRA? Is that federal sharing the same from all federal royalties, or is it vary? NPRA, Arctic Wildlife Refuge, 3 miles out?
Yeah, Representative Hannon through the chair, it does vary depending on which of those categories you're in. And again, we'll provide the document that lays that out for the committee. All right, so on slide 9, talking about gross value at point of production. This is a widely used term in the production tax. You'll also hear it referred to as the wellhead value. Those terms are sometimes used interchangeably. So to get to gross value, we take the total taxable value and we subtract any transportation costs. You'll also hear those called.
We're going to take a brief at ease. So I've got.
We're back on the record. Please continue.
Excellent. Madam Chair, again for the record, Dan Stickle. Transportation costs, or also known as netback costs, are subtracted from the taxable value to arrive at the gross value at point of production. So we start with the $66 per barrel ANS price that you see reported. That's actually the price on the West Coast when the oil is sold in California, Washington, or wherever. So you actually net back from that sales price. You subtract the tanker costs from getting to Valdez to the West Coast, the tariff for the Trans-Alaska pipeline, the tariff for any feeder pipelines, and any quality bank adjustment, because the oil quality coming from different fields on the slope is slightly different. And that gets you back to the gross value. So you see here in fiscal year 2020, we're estimating $8.81 per barrel of transportation costs to get to about a $57 gross value at point of production per barrel, and a taxable gross value of about $9.8 billion for fiscal year 2020.
Representative Rauscher has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So that $8.81 for transportation, that's a flat rate, not an average. That's just what it's going to cost us irregardless, correct?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, the $8.81 is an average.
Oh, so it is an average.
Right. Okay, so each company has a slightly different marine cost.
Kind of figured it would have to be, but I was just wondering. Thank you.
It's clear as mud. Clear as mud.
Moving on to slide 10, looking at lease expenditures. So the production tax is essentially a modified version of a net profits tax. And companies are allowed to deduct both capital expenditures and operating expenditures. For capital expenditures, we rely in general on IRS guidelines to determine what qualifies as a capital expenditure. One difference from an income tax is that companies receive an immediate deduction of their capital costs. There's no depreciation schedule in the production tax. Operating expenditures then are essentially any allowable expenditures that are not a capital expenditure. It's kind of everything else, ongoing costs of operations and labor. Mm-hmm. So when we're looking at lease expenditures, there's, in addition to operating and capital, there's two other terms to understand. One is allowable lease expenditures and one is deductible lease expenditures. Allowable lease expenditures refers to generally any cost in the unit directly associated with producing the oil. This is everything that's allowed under the production tax code. It's important to note that not everything is an allowable lease expenditure. For example, financing costs, lease acquisition costs, dispute resolution costs, dismantlement, removal, and restoration costs are some examples of expenditures related to operating the oil fields that are not allowable under production tax statutes. And then the other term, which you see here in the income statement, is deductible lease expenditures. Deductible expenditures is a term of art that we use solely for presentation purposes. This is not something that appears in any statute or regulation. When we present deductible lease expenditures, we're talking about that portion of allowable lease expenditures that are applied in the tax calculation in a given year up to the gross value at point of production. And any expenditures beyond those deductible lease expenditures will turn into a carry forward lease expenditure that a company can use in a future year to offset a future year's taxes.
Just one moment. Representative Hannon has a question.
Can I go? I was thinking you were ready to change the slide. So I want to. The deductible capital expenditures, and you said that they were not depreciated, they were in the year of use. So you bought $1 million widget and you can deduct it that year. So it's just the entirety of it is deductible in the year of expenditure.
Representative Hand, through the chair, that's correct.
Can you give me an example through the chair? Sorry. Give me an example of the kind of capital that is done in a year, because I guess I'm just thinking that must be widely varied, that some years you're buying a bunch of widgets and some widget parts, and other years you're only buying one widget and one screw.
Sure. Representative Hannon, through the chair. So an example would be putting up a building on the unit, drilling a well that's going to have a long-term life, where under a, like a corporate income tax, you might depreciate that cost over time. In our production tax, you deduct that entirely in the year earned. And it is typical in these types of taxes around the world to have some sort of benefit for capital spending like that.
One more follow-up?
Because
that's where I was thinking. Are typically a whole well is built in 1 year? Because I was thinking that it spans a longer time period. So how do you portion out the time between ordering the parts, shipping the parts, and getting it put up at the drill site, that takes more than 1 year? And so how you differentiate that capital expenditure? I got a couple that, we do it in one season. He's shaking his head in the back. So that may not be an auditor's question.
Sure, Representative Hand through the chair, that might better be an auditor's question, and we can get back with some clarity on what we do when there's a multi-year capital project like that.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Rauscher and then Hopkins.
Just for clarity, what is give us an example of a lease expenditure through the chair. Thank you.
Sure. Representative Rauscher through the chair. So a lease expenditure is going to be any deductible, any operating or capital expenditure. It's basically the cost of operating the unit. Any cost directly associated with the producing of the oil, so drilling a well would be a lease expenditure. Putting up a facility to process the oil would be a lease expenditure. The ongoing costs of labor.
So through the chair, it has to have to perform on the lease, right?
Representative Rauscher through the chair, generally associated with the lease.
Associated with the lease, but not through the chair, but not necessarily on the lease?
There are some costs that could be off the lease.
Okay,
and associated, yes.
Okay, we have Representative Hopkins and Rasmussen, then Spanholz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you said a moment ago the deductible lease expenditures is the term of art of what is allowed under the allowable lease expenditures up to the gross value of point of production, gross value at point of production. Does that mean that on this slide, if we add up, say that that $15.55 and that $11.71, say those numbers are larger for that year and they go up to a combination of $60. Does that mean that there would be a zero, that production tax value below would be would result in $0, and there would be that $2.81 carry over to the next year?
Representative Hopkins to the chair, that's generally the right way to look at it. So on slide 10 in this example, we're estimating about $4.7 billion in lease expenditures are able to be used by companies to offset their gross value at point of production down to zero. And after applying those lease expenditures, looking at the very bottom of the slide in the highlighted section, there's an additional $823.6 million of lease expenditures that were not used in a tax calculation. So this could be a company that doesn't have enough production to use up all those lease expenditures. It could be a company that's still in the exploration of development phase. So those $823 million of lease expenditures, those get carried forward, and the company could use them next year, 5 years from now.
Thank you. So follow up?
Mm-hmm.
So in this model then that you have here, the state receives $524 million, and we owe $823 million.
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, the $823 million is a carry-forward lease expenditure that can be used to offset production tax value in a future year. So it's not that we owe that $823 million. It's a it's an asset to the company to potentially reduce their taxes in a future year. And the maximum benefit would be 35% of that lease expenditure amount.
Can you explain that number, that 35%?
It's the tax rate.
It's the tax rate. Okay.
Yeah.
Didn't quite follow all that, but that's okay.
Just really quickly, I want to say that it's 43-55-165 that has the lease expenditure provisions for statute. It's like 5 pages long. I'm just going to pass this around because it may be of interest to folks. Next is Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. So you had mentioned on the previous slide that Alaska has to pay about $8.80 just to get the oil to market, which most companies, I would assume, in the lower 48 don't take on that cost. Is that correct?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, there's a net back cost for most oil production. It varies depending on the field. You have, for instance, production in some areas of Alberta, which are very far from infrastructure, and their net back costs are very high. You have fields that are very close to market, and they have a much lower net back cost than we do.
Okay. Could I clarify also the question a little bit, because I think I heard you say that that's 881 that the state of Alaska has to pay that other states don't have.
No,
to
it's
pay?
As a deduction.
Okay,
is that
I just
correct?
To okay. Clarify that for the record.
Follow up to my other question though. So how would you say the $27 deductible credit, whatever we want to call it, that we have compared to another location like West Texas or North Dakota, who I'm assuming those locations also don't have major costs for transportation to get to market?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, again, Dan Stickle for the record. I don't have a comparison of our cost structure to other jurisdictions handy. In general, it's safe to say that Alaska is a high-cost jurisdiction.
So for all expenditures, including the lease expenditures, you would say that it's probably accurate that Alaska is going to be higher for even the lease expenditure costs, not just the transportation?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, I think it would be safe to say that Alaska is either similar or higher. We're definitely not a low-cost jurisdiction.
Thank you.
Rep. Sponholz.
Thank you. My question is about something that's not on this page, but I want to understand where it intersects here. And we talk a lot about net operating losses as it relates to oil taxes. Is that a term of art that relates to the non-deductible lease deductible lease expenditures or non-deductible lease expenditures, or is that not on this page at all?
Sure. Representative Sponholz, through the chair. So this relates to the non-deductible lease expenditures. Mm-hmm. And prior to calendar 2018, under the previous tax law, mm-hmm. those $824 million would get converted to a net operating loss credit. Mm-hmm. With the tax changes that took place beginning in 2018, companies no longer earn a credit for those excess lease expenditures. Instead, they have a carried forward provision for those lease expenditures.
So to clarify, we don't call them net operating losses anymore because they're not actually cashable, but they can carry it forward as a credit for up to 5 years?
Representative Sponholz, to the chair, we are referring to those lease expenditures as a carried forward annual loss, mm-hmm. and they can carry those forward indefinitely. Okay. After the 8th or 11th year of earning a carry forward lease expenditure, there is a provision where the value erodes over time, mm-hmm. if the company doesn't use it up within 8 or 11 years. But they do get to carry that forward indefinitely.
And they're called carry forward what?
Carried forward annual loss.
All right, thanks.
Carry forward loss. Loss carry forward.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
And I think, too, the net operating losses is used for the corporate income tax. And so I think to differentiate mm-hmm. the lease expenditure carry forward versus the corporate income tax losses, mm-hmm. one net operating losses, one carry forward.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Correct. So we're talking here only about the production tax in particular, and there is a completely separate carried forward loss provision in corporate income tax, and corporate income tax could take up its own presentation or two. Yeah.
Just looking at the time, I'm thinking maybe we should let you go through the next slides that get us to slide 15 that just walk through each of these steps, and you know, and then we'll do as many questions as we can with the time that we'll have left, and then clearly we're going to need to have a follow-up meeting so we can really just, you know, go through each level in more detail.
Absolutely.
That's okay with committee members. That way we'll just at least get the broad brush for this meeting.
Sounds good. So, Madam Chair, slide 11 is the calculation of the production tax value, or acronym of PTV. Production tax value is simply the gross value at point of production less deductible lease expenditures. It's essentially a measure of net profit, or the cash left over after subtracting royalties and all costs of production. Each company is going to have a separate production tax value based on all of their North Slope activity, including all fields and developments. So if a company is operating an existing field and investing in a new field, both of those will be pooled together for calculating their production tax value. And so this production tax value is our tax base for the production tax, and it's also the basis for the effective any effective tax rate analysis and distribution of cash flows analysis that we'll be presenting in the addendum. And then moving on to slide 12, Madam Chair, there's two parallel tax calculations that are essentially done side by side. There's a gross minimum tax and then a net profits tax, and the company pays the higher of those two calculations. The minimum tax at current prices and any prices over $25 per barrel, let's hope that's always the case, the minimum tax is 4% of gross value at point of production. So for fiscal year 2020, the minimum tax is 4% times the $9.8 billion of gross value, or about $394 million. And then moving on to slide 13, this looks at the net tax calculation. So the net tax is based on the production tax value of about $5.15 billion minus a gross value reduction provision. This is an incentive for new development that excludes a portion of the value of new fields from the tax calculation to get to the adjusted production tax value, and the 35% net tax rate applies to that adjusted production tax value. So here for fiscal year 2020, the 35% tax rate before application of any credits generates a tax before credits of about $1.76 billion. And then, of course, as we know, there are tax credits to offset that. On slide 14, the largest tax credit, which is actually an integral part of the tax calculation, are the per taxable barrel credits. There's two different varieties of those, which are reported here in aggregate. The vast majority of these are non-gross value reduction eligible production. Those fields receive a sliding scale credit ranging from $0 to $8 per taxable barrel. The $8 per taxable barrel applies when the wellhead value is less than $80 per barrel. So roughly when ANS prices are less than about $89 per barrel, is the $8 credit applies. For any production eligible for gross value reduction, again, these are new fields during their initial period of production, those fields receive a flat $5 per taxable barrel credit. And the $5 per taxable barrel credit can reduce below minimum tax. The sliding scale credit for non-gross value reduction production cannot reduce a company's tax liability below the minimum tax. Any of these per taxable barrel credits that are not used in the year incurred are forfeited. They can't be carried forward. They can't be refunded. That's true of any credits under this section of the tax code. So for fiscal year 2020, for example, there's about a little over $1.3 billion of per taxable barrel credits are generated based on the amount of production, and then a little over $1.2 billion are actually able to be claimed by the companies in calculating the production tax liability. And there's some additional tax credits against liability shown here, the $22 million. This includes some small producer credits and prior year credits. And so you end up taking the higher of your tax, which was the $1.76 billion net profits tax, minus these credits to get to your total tax after credits of $481 million for fiscal year 2020. And then on slide 15, there's a few other adjustments that we include to get to the estimated production tax revenue that you see in the revenue forecast. This $43 million is an aggregation of several smaller items. There's prior year tax payments and refunds, private landowner royalty tax, a hazardous release, conservation surcharge, any tax revenue from ANS gas production, and any net tax liability from Cook Inlet production takes you from the estimated tax after credits for North Slope Oil to the total tax revenue that we are forecasting for production tax for the year of the $524.7 million. And that represents the total cash that we're estimating to the general fund from production tax in the budget year.
Okay, thank you. That way we at least got through that. And just that $2.80 is what it looks like on a per barrel basis, right? The per barrel severance tax.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The $2.80 represents the estimated production tax after credits per taxable barrel of North Slope Oil production.
Thank you. Okay, we did have, oh, sorry.
Can you say that again?
Sure, Representative Hopkins. So for fiscal year 2020, per taxable barrel of North Slope Oil production, we are estimating $2.80 per taxable barrel in production tax revenue.
Thank you.
After credits.
Okay, we have a few questions, and so we'll do these, and then of course we're going to run out of time. So thank you so much for getting through that. We had the first question was Representative Rauscher, was Representative Sponholz, then Rauscher, then Tuck. Representative Sponholz.
You described the gross value reduction as an incentive for new development. That's a $5 per barrel credit, essentially. What's the term of that? What's the terms of that? How long is the incentive last, or to what projects does that apply?
Sure. Representative Sponholz through the chair, so I glossed over that a little bit. The gross value reduction, this is a provision that excludes either 20% or 30% of the gross value of production from the production tax value calculation for certain new fields. It's 20% for any qualifying new field, or 30% if the field is comprised exclusively of state-issued leases with greater than 12.5% royalty. Currently, all the gross value reduction production that we have is receiving at the 20% rate. And this benefit expires after 7 years of production or any 3 years with greater than a $70 ANS price.
Okay, thank you.
Again, just clear as mud. Representative Rauscher.
And I don't even know if I understand my question enough to be able to ask it. But somehow, along the way, you said, should they decide to use the per barrel taxable credit? And I'm thinking, isn't it automatic? And does it just happen because the barrels came and went? I mean, am I lost here?
Representative Rauscher through the chair. So a company, when they fill out their production tax form and their calculation, they choose to claim the credits to which they're entitled. And so there's certain provisions where a company may elect to use one credit or another credit and have that decision be made in whatever is in their best interest.
I think I understand. Thank you very much.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So slides 12 and 13, you had it's one or the other. But when you looks like it's the same number, so I'm guessing that those are two combined when we look at the overall 2020. How much would that value be? So I was just curious if you had any idea between the net tax and gross value reduction versus the gross minimum tax, percentage-wise, what that number may reflect one over the other. Does that make any sense? My understanding is when you were going over slides 12 and 13, they can either do the gross minimum tax method or do the net tax and gross value reduction method. Did I hear that wrong?
Representative Tuck, that's correct. So the gross minimum tax, as shown on slide 12, actually functions as a tax floor. So what happens is the company ends up paying the higher of in terms of the tax before credits. And you see here on slide 12, the minimum tax that we're estimating for fiscal year 20 of $394 million. Before credits, and then on slide 13, the net tax of $1.76 billion. You make those two calculations, and then the higher of those two calculations becomes the tax before credits.
And just to clarify, the company doesn't get a choice. Dan said it rather well, but it is they calculate both ways, and then they pay the higher of.
The higher of the two. And so if I may follow up real quick, Madam Chair, so that split, as you actually can see between those two columns, right, 2.29 minimum and then the 10.22 net. Because that number, 1.759, is the same on both pages, but both are in that calculation of that total amount. So my question was, it looks like what percentage of the 1.759 is the gross minimum version versus the net tax and gross value?
Sure. Representative Tuck, through the chair, we can make that calculation and provide it.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Do you have one more?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Hopkins, that'll be the last question for today.
Thanks. And this rolls it back up to just a small question on the transportation cost. Of that $8.81, do you know what the tariff is for TAPS itself and what that cost going through the line? Because that one would be fairly static, correct, as opposed to shipping costs and things like that.
Sure. Representative Hopkins, through the chair, I believe the TAPS tariff is in the
addendum.
$5 to $6 per barrel range.
Okay. So the majority of that $8.81. 50 to 60% of it would be the TAPS tariff.
The TAPS tariff is the largest portion. I don't have the breakout at my fingertips. We absolutely have that, and we'll include that in our response document.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, so clearly we need another two-hour meeting for this to get through all the questions. But today, the things that I heard people ask for were the list of ownership versus the royalty and tax rate, state, federal, offshore, and then the auditor issue that Representative Hannon had about an expense, you know, how is a multi-year expense factored in for purposes of taxes. It sounded like Representative Tuck's question was more about the effective tax rate. That's what I thought, but sounds like you got the question if I missed it.
If I may, Madam Chair, I didn't realize that this is highlighting that second column. The first one was highlighting the first column. So I apologize. I thought it was all using the same number. So forgive me for that question.
Okay. Scratch that one. And then just the last question about the transportation, which portion is TAPS. And I know I've seen that because I've seen some with the feeder lines and stuff like that. So, so if you share those items with us, then we will certainly share them with committee members. And then if committee members look at the addendum, it has some share between the federal, state, and municipalities, and then it has some of that historical information, which might be of interest to folks when people sort of talk about the breakdown. So thank you so much for your presentation today. We'll work to get you back on this calendar as soon as possible. And on Wednesday, please look for announcements because of the joint session. We may have to delay to the call of chair, and if the day goes long, maybe look at
a reschedule on that one. So if there's no other business to come before the committee, we'll adjourn at 3:07 p.m. Thank you.